You are listening to season 6 of Future Ecologies.
So, as traditional with Critical Mass, we usually have some brief announcements before we start. So if anyone has any brief announcements, come up to the microphone. Then we'll do a safety talk. And then we'll ride! I don't see anybody clamoring for the microphone.
Testing, testing. I'm Mendel.
And I'm Adam.
And this is the sound of Critical Mass here in Vancouver.
This tape is from 2009, but it's a tradition that carries on somewhat regularly to this day, here and in cities all over the world.
For the uninitiated, Critical Mass is a periodic occurrence where hundreds or even thousands of cyclists gather to overwhelm city streets with their presence, all in a joyous protest for safer bicycle infrastructure.
This flash mob springs up seemingly out of nowhere,
coming out of the woodwork, as it were,
and just as quickly ebbs away, vanishing until the next. So that's Critical Mass, but this is Critical Mast, with a T, as in masting. And what is masting, I hear you ask?
So this is actually quite a difficult question to answer. Masting is quite a tricky topic to define. So I think a relaxed definition of masting is useful, and it helps us to incorporate the real diversity of characteristics or variation that come under this term. So masting kind of boils down to highly variable and synchronized seed production in perennial plants.
This is Andrew Hackett Payne.
I'm a senior lecturer at the University of Liverpool in the United Kingdom, and I work on forests generally, but in particular I work on forest reproduction and on this strange phenomenon that we know as masting.
In the simplest terms, masting is when a population of plants, typically but not always trees, all produce a huge crop of seeds at the same time.
In statistics, I think they call it a crap ton.
Yeah, a crop ton.
Yeah, in a mast year, we've got trees or other plants dropping way more seeds than you would see on average.
So these are long-lived plants, and they're plants that rather than reproducing regularly each year, so producing an approximately constant seed crop each year, instead they strongly vary their allocation to reproduction. In a very typical European masting species like Vega sylvatica, European beech, one of the most common broadleaf species in Europe, or actually the numbers are very similar for Picea glauca, for white spruce in North America. A big tree in a very good year might produce 500,000 seeds. And that's not just individual trees deciding that this is the year to go big, but they do that in a synchronized way.
This isn't just one tree here and one tree there. It's all the trees of a given species in a given area, all masting at once.
How big of an area? How many trees? Why? How?
We're going to get into it. But first, I think we should say a little bit about how this episode came to be. How do you recall the germ of this story, Adam?
Yeah, Critical Mast. This one is a little bit of a blast from the past.
It was a long time ago.
We were on a road trip together recording sounds for our first season. And we were just spitballing puns on ecology, I think, right?
Yeah, I think this is literally the first time we started from the title of an episode before we had anything else.
Yeah, the title came first before the story. Like, do you remember any of the other ones?
The only one that I can honestly remember is Galls to the Wall, which I think we should still do.
Yeah. The ones that stick are the ones that we should still do. So Critical Mast stuck.
And then, you know, some years go by and we have another idea. Some might say it's nuts.
It's nuts.
Basically, we thought to ourselves, wouldn't it be funny if a whole population of nature podcasts produced their own stories about masting or inspired by masting?
And then dropped them all at the same time.
So from Future Ecologies,
and with supporting episodes from our friends at Outside In, Nature's Archive, Golden State Naturalist, Jumpstart Nature, and Learning from Nature, the Biomimicry Podcast.
This is Critical Mast.
Broadcasting from the unceded, shared, and asserted territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh. This is Future Ecologies, exploring the shape of our world through ecology, design, and sound.
Okay, just to drive it home, what is masting?
So masting is, you probably already know at this point, is a population level phenomenon. An individual tree does not mast, a population of trees mast. So the problem when I started, and this was back about 40 years ago now, was that nobody had really seemed to pay much attention to defining or figuring out what a population was.
This is Walt Koenig, research zoologist emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. And despite being one of the leading researchers into the mystery of masting, Walt is, by his own description, more of a bird person.
What can I say? Masting was just kind of a side thing. I spent most of my career studying acorn woodpeckers. Acorn woodpeckers, surprisingly enough, are highly dependent on acorns. They're famous for storing acorns in what we call granaries. They use trees, they drill hundreds to thousands of little holes in them and stick acorns in them individually. And so it was clear early on that the birds were highly dependent on the acorn crop. And so we slowly got interested in trying to learn something about that. And now that I'm retired, it's kind of the better project because I don't have to climb up to nests and my wife doesn't want me falling out of a tree. So now, starting in another couple of days, I go around every year and count acorns around the state, which can be done on the ground. And one of the main questions that cropped up early on was how spatially synchronous the acorn crop is. So when it's a good crop here in Upper Carmel Valley, where I live now and where I did most of my research, does that mean it's a good crop up in the Bay Area? Does it mean it's a good crop up in the foothills of the Sierras? Nobody seemed to know the answer.
So this scale of synchrony is really one of the most remarkable characteristics of masting, I think.
I just want to underline here that this masting behavior shows up in all sorts of different plants and in a diversity of trees. Andrew's research tends to focus on European beech, while Walt is primarily interested in oaks and acorns. And there are a lot of different oaks in California. One of my favorite things about the place.
You got Oregon oak, white oak, blue oak, coast live oak, interior live oak, black oak. What's that one in Southern California? Yeah, it's a Mexican species. It just makes it up, and we do the Santa Rosa Plateau, which has them. And I'll think of it in, as I like to say, in between 5 minutes and 24 hours.
That one is the Engelmann oak, or Pasadena oak, with one of the smallest ranges of any species of oak in California.
And each species has a different pattern.
Meaning, even just between these different species of oaks, a given year could be a mast year for some, but not for others. And the problem of this spatial synchrony remained central to the mystery.
We spent several years trying to figure out what scale was appropriate. I started out, for example, by starting at the coast and counting acorns every 10 kilometers till we got inland a ways. We did that for a few years until it turned out that it was clear that that was too small a scale. And somewhere along the line in the 1990s, I had a postdoc who said we really needed to do this right. And doing it right basically meant spending a week or so driving around California, looking at marked trees and doing a survey of the acorn crop at different sites around the state. We go to sites that are over 700 kilometers apart, one end of the Central Valley to the other. And the question is, do they actually produce acorns synchronously or not?
We're kind of hoping you might answer that question.
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked. It turns out that, okay, the way spatial synchrony almost basically always works is that sites that are closer together are unsurprisingly more synchronous than sites that are farther apart. And it turns out they are spatially synchronous over very large distances, hundreds of kilometers. And we're talking millions, if not tens or hundreds of millions of trees.
Mast years in Denmark and in Central Europe, in Sweden, seem to happen generally in the same years. The pattern is not periodic. It's not strictly stochastic either, because while I said there's no periodic pattern, there is one very important pattern, which is that we very, very rarely see consecutive years of high seed production. A year of very high seed production is almost always followed by a failure year. And it was quite common in the old literature for masting to be described as some kind of cyclic pattern. We're still kind of pushing back against this literature and the way that these ideas have seeded in. Oh, sorry, that was an accidental pun.
That's okay. And honestly, totally appropriate for this episode. But myth busted.
Yeah. Mast production, as it turns out, is not like the cycles of cicadas or solar storms. We can't just count the years between mast years and call that a reliable pattern. And it's too bad, because we've been trying to figure out masting for a long, long time. Like Karl Marx wrote about mast production, didn't he?
Oh my God, that's so bad.
Masting has been recognized for a really long time. Really exceptional years of acorn production, particularly in Europe, was, I think, noted by the Romans, but certainly by the medieval period in Europe. There's a lot of interest in masting in relation to acorns as a food source, particularly for pigs.
People have been interested in the acorn crop for many hundreds of years because acorns provided an excellent food resource, particularly for their hogs. Back in the day, people spent a lot of time going out there hitting trees, trying to knock down the acorns so that they could feed their hogs in various parts of the world.
That's a process known as pannage. So when pigs are put into oak woodlands in particular to feed on the acorns, that was an important rite and important within European legal systems in the medieval period.
And Spain's an interesting case, of course.
In Spain, spacious oak woodlands called dehesas are iconic for their pasture and their acorn-fed Iberian ham,
which is highly prized.
Cue happy pigs in a dehesa. And dear listener, just so you know how dedicated we are to getting you audio straight from the source, I spent a full day pedaling my ass up into the foothills of Spain outside of Sevilla on a janky old bike to get this particular soundscape, only to have the derailleur get sucked into the spokes and break off, leaving me stranded in the middle of nowhere on a Sunday.
So much for critical mass.
I wish there were like 100 other people biking with me, because do you know what happens in rural areas in Spain on a Sunday, Mendel?
What happens in rural areas in Spain on a Sunday, Adam?
A whole lot of nothing. We couldn't even hitchhike out of there. So I recorded this audio while waiting on the side of the road to be rescued by my own mother, who was also on vacation. Thanks, Mom.
That's lucky.
So, you're welcome.
Yeah, whatever the results.
Yeah, I guess it would be better if my sound was better. I'm sorry. I did my best.
It was so high effort for a very indistinct recording of some pigs.
And that's us in a nutshell, Mendel. That's us in a nutshell. High effort.
Indistinct results.
Indistinct results.
Anyway, back to Walt.
Those dehesas are well tended. And I can't help but think that part of the reason that they do so well is that they've been paying attention to those trees for a long time and probably choosing trees, selecting trees that would produce acorns that are edible. I have a couple of Spanish colleagues who claim that when they get hungry out there, they can just pick off an acorn from one of those trees in Spain and eat the thing, which means not that they don't have tannins, but they do not have the kind of tannins that the oaks here in California do.
And according to a chapter that Walt contributed to an anthology, the oaks of the Spanish dehesas may have been selectively cultivated, not only for their palatability, but also to make them mast less, regularizing the annual acorn crop and making it more reliable for the ham economy.
Oh, well, good for me. I made that up, of course, but my Spanish colleagues did not make me take it out, so I assume that there's at least some possibility it's true.
In any case, the point stands, people have had plenty of motivation to notice these irregular bumper crops.
So there are data sets that go way back for some of these species.
German foresters in particular were describing and making observations of masting in the 17th century.
Well, here in California, the famous use of all those acorns were the Native Americans. There are tribes in California which have been estimated to get half their calories from acorns. Now, the amount of effort you would have to go to collect, protect, and then process enough acorns to get half your calories, half your food out of those things is just mind-boggling, but it was a critical resource.
Was and is. Acorns continue to be an important cultural food for the indigenous peoples of California, which we will come back to in a future episode.
Of course, that's why there are these grinding rocks everywhere in the foothills of California, because women spent a vast amount of time hanging out grinding these acorns up. And then they, of course, had to leach them, because here in California, they are completely inedible unless you leach the tannins out of them. But despite that, they've been an important food resource for humans here for a long time.
Shout out to another wonderful episode from our friends at Outside In. If you want to know more about how this traditional food is being revived, before we eventually get to it, cue up The Acorn, an Ohlone love story from 2021.
But before you do that, there are more details of masting to cover, because it turns out they've been a hard nut to crack. It's only in recent decades that we've made real scientific progress.
You know, like a lot of things, it took a while before they started asking the kinds of evolutionary questions that we are now focused on.
Yeah, so masting appears across the plant tree of life. It's very common in conifers.
Which are cone-bearing plants.
It's very common in angiosperms.
Which are flowering plants.
The patterns associated with when masting appears in the tree of life and when it doesn't appear in the tree of life indicate that it's a strategy that has evolved multiple times over the evolution of plants. So it seems to be a strategy that emerges, and then perhaps when it's not beneficial, it disappears again and then can reemerge.
So masting is a pattern that we see across plant evolution in different lineages, arising independently, which means it's got to be a decent survival strategy. But remember that after cashing in all of their energy and resources on a mast year, plants almost always take the next year off.
Going from tons of seed to nuns of seed.
In a mast year, as much resource might be allocated to reproduction, so the production of flowers and the fruits and the seeds, as is allocated to tree growth. As much as half of all of the resources allocated above ground might be going into reproduction. And then in a non-mast year, they might produce zero. So it's a phenomenal switching of resource allocation. These plants actively miss opportunities for reproduction. So they have a growing season, they have the opportunity to produce flowers and fruits in that year, and yet they pass on that opportunity.
Which at first seems a little counterintuitive. I mean, like, after all, reproduction is kind of the name of the evolutionary game. If masting comes at the cost of taking a year-long break, it's got to be worth it. But why?
Spoiler alert, nobody knows for sure. But we have a few solid leads, a crop load of seeds, and we're about to get into the weeds. That's after the break.
Mm-hmm. Hi, this is Eden. I'm an assistant producer for Future Ecologies. I think you might be listening to the show because Future Ecologies combines this love for sound arts and storytelling and ecology and people into one big, beautiful narrative. And I just wanted to say that there's a reason we can be as silly and experimental as we want to be. Future Ecologies is completely 100% listener supported. And if you're glad that this podcast exists, you know, free for everyone and with no ads or sponsors, you can really thank our amazing community, whose names are all on futureecologies.net/join. The best way to support the show is through our Patreon for as little as $1 each month. Another option is always to share the podcast, share it with your friends and family, colleagues, strangers on the internet, anyone who will listen, share it on your socials at Future Ecologies. Or you can leave us a comment or review wherever you're listening. And if you want to get our bonus episode feed, merch, access to our community Discord server, book club, and more, head to patreon.com/futureecologies and support the show for as little as $1 each month. That's patreon.com/futureecologies. Thank you. Let's get back to the show.
And we're back. I'm Mendel.
I'm Adam. And today we are taking our own silly pun very seriously.
You might call it our masterpiece.
Where we left off, we were just about to get into why masting, this strange behavior of synchronous seed superabundance, immediately followed by synchronous seed scarcity, has evolved time and time again, independently, all across the plant kingdom.
Now, there are lots of reasons why masting might be beneficial to plants and why it might be selected for. But it seems there are two main theories as to why masting is particularly beneficial under some circumstances.
Once again, we are joined by Andrew Hackett Payne. And the first rationale for masting is that it makes it easier for plants to get pollinated. Here's Walt Koenig.
Oaks, for example, most of these masting species are not self-pollinating. They have to be cross-pollinated by other trees. So if you're producing flowers, you're dependent on pollen from some neighbor or some other tree down the ways. For true oaks, they're all wind-pollinated. There's lots of pollen out there, but it is just floating around in the air in no particular direction. And the odds of any one pollen grain falling on a flower is probably strikingly low, even by astronomical standards.
So it's quite hard to get external pollen into your flowers if you're, for example, in the forest. They could just flower very intensely every year, but that has a pretty major resource cost and would lead to trade-offs with, for example, growth.
If trees sort of get together and decide, okay, this is going to be a good year. We're going to produce lots of flowers, female flowers. We're going to produce lots of catkins, male flowers, lots of pollen. And that's going to be much more efficient in terms of pollinating everybody, each other, including myself, than if we don't sort of do this synchronously.
Years of very high seed production have higher pollination efficiency, more of the flowers overall are pollinated. And that's good from a plant's perspective because producing a flower that doesn't result in a fruit is ultimately a waste of resources.
Another factor here is that once you're a plant in a masting population, there's a pretty severe penalty to you if you don't play along.
Yeah, if you're the odd one out, wasting lots of pollen when everyone else is taking a break, or failing to capitalize on the mast hysteria, you're far less likely to pass on your genes into the next generation.
So masting, if you think about it, is kind of a snowball of selection pressure, and it just keeps rolling. The second rationale for masting is called the predator satiation hypothesis.
Almost everybody agrees that predator satiation is probably often a major, if not the primary factor, evolutionary factor driving masting behavior.
So plant seeds generally are full of carbon and fats, proteins. A side effect of that is that those same nutrients are usually a good source of food for mammals, insects, and various other organisms which like to eat seeds.
If trees just produce the same number of acorns every year, the predator populations would presumably end up reaching a point where they would eat most of those seeds every year. By varying it a lot from one year to the next, in a really bad year, they can cut those populations of predators down.
And then 1 year or 2 years or some years later, when that predator population has been suppressed through starvation, the plants go all in, they produce bumper seed crops, and any of those seed predators that are still around, well, they have a great year, but their population is so small and has been suppressed to be so small by the starvation years that a larger proportion of the seeds escape predation. And that can actually be remarkably effective.
Here in California, we have a fairly intact predator populations. We have lots of band-tailed pigeons. We got lots of acorn woodpeckers. We got lots of mice. We got lots of deer. We got lots of everything that loves eating acorns. But in most years, if you go out there, you will not see hardly any acorns on the ground. And if you do, they're usually going to be gone the next morning because some deer is going to come along and scarf it up. Whereas in a really good acorn year, every so often, then you'll find acorns lying around on the ground because there's just not enough animals out there to eat them all, as hard as they may try.
In the 1980s, when masting patterns in European beech in the UK were really strongly expressed, around 2% of seeds were lost to a specialist seed predator, a very boring little moth that lives in the canopy. I've studied them indirectly for a decade. I've never knowingly seen one. But their larvae feed on beech seeds. They leave a very characteristic drill hole in the seeds.
Underestimate this specialist seed predator, the beech moth, at your own peril. It's known to be a weapon of mass destruction.
In the 1980s, when masting cycles were really pronounced, overall seed predation losses to this specialist moth were about 2%. In more recent decades, beech masting patterns in the UK have changed. Masting has become quite a lot less pronounced or remarkably less pronounced. So we don't have such strong failure years anymore. We kind of have lowish years rather than zero years. And we don't have super peak years anymore. We have kind of medium to high years. The whole variability, year-to-year variability, has been dampened. And now losses to this seed predator have exploded. It's more like 40% of seeds, of viable seeds, are now destroyed by the seed predator. So it's been a massive shift, and it's a really alarming but effective natural experiment to show just how effective masting can be at suppressing seed predators.
You might be wondering, given how effective it is at reducing seed predators, why would this particular tree, European beech, not be masting like it used to?
Nothing masts like it used to anymore.
Oh my god. We'll get back to that a little later. But first, a wrinkle in the predator satiation theory.
One of the contradictory things about oaks and acorns is that the oaks are producing acorns. The acorns are how they reproduce, and they want to have a lot of them out there. And in order to have a lot of them out there, they have to evade the predators. And this is countered by the fact that their main dispersers are also some of those predators. The obvious examples being the scrub jays and the stellar jays out there, because they're the ones that are picking those acorns and then sticking them in the ground in various places, moving them uphill even. There's a famous uphill planters paper written by Joseph Grinnell back in the day. How do oaks disperse uphills? Well, you know, you get those acorns picked by a scrub jay, and they fly uphill to their territory and stick it in the ground, and there you go. So they can't do too good a job at, you know, getting rid of all those predators. I always think of them as kind of half-assed masters. This gets back to a issue with acorn woodpeckers, if you don't mind for a minute, which is that they tend to be restricted to areas that have at least two species of oaks, Presumably because when you only have one species, it's going to fail every couple, 3-4 years, and the populations of the birds are going to be in trouble. Whereas when you have two species, you know, they are not likely to be strongly correlated with each other. And so the odds of both of them failing in the same year is going to be reduced significantly. And the more species you have, the lower the probability that all of them are going to have a bad year in the same time.
So now we come to the big question. How do plants do this? The evolutionary benefits of masting rely on coordination between individuals. So how do all of the trees of a particular species across a vast region, sometimes their entire range, synchronize their seed production?
Could it be a conspiracy of the fungi, relaying the signal from root to root across their mycelial fiber optics?
Okay, so trees may very well communicate over short distances, you know, groups of trees that are within the same little meadow or something may communicate in various ways through their roots or whatever, but they are not doing this over distances of tens or hundreds of kilometers. So that's not likely to be a factor, which is really driving the kind of synchrony that we see.
I think a good example of how below ground communication can't explain the patterns of masting that we see would be something as simple as to see how strongly masting is synchronized on either side of the English Channel in Europe. So if you are in the south of England, your masting patterns will be almost identical to the populations of beech or oak in northern France. And I don't think anyone is suggesting that there are mycorrhizal networks that extend under the English Channel and connect the United Kingdom with Europe.
I mean, at least not since Brexit. Am I right?
So sorry to disappoint you. Yeah.
I guess just because it's not mushrooms doesn't mean it's not cool.
I'm proud of you for saying so. So what is the most parsimonious explanation? Drumroll, please.
It turns out that if you look at weather, so rainfall, temperature, which are sort of the two main things that there are data on, if nothing else, they are also highly spatially synchronous over distances of hundreds, in some cases, 1,000 or more kilometers, basically everywhere in the world. So there is no problem having rainfall or temperature having effects, which is what the trees are all sensitive to. And that is by far the most likely factor which is going to be synchronizing these trees.
So what's happening here is that plants are responding to variations in their environment. And in relation to masting, there are, I think, two main sources of what we might think of as information that they're responding to. So one is weather variability, photoperiod as well. So day length, that's also something that's important. It helps them to work out when they should be responding to temperature. There may also be some influences of radiation as well. The second source of information is their own internal plant reserves and their own internal signaling. They're not going to invest heavily in seed production when their internal reserves are depleted, either because they simply don't have the reserves to fuel a super peak year, or because doing that might deplete their reserves dangerously and lead to trade-offs, for example, with mortality. And so it may be that this ecological synchrony in terms of masting is a kind of emergent property, something that just happens as a consequence of processes that are happening at local scales that are regulated by temperature, and temperature just happens to be spatially synchronized at scales of up to hundreds of kilometers. We just don't really know at the moment. It's one of the open questions as to whether that large-scale spatial synchrony has any kind of adaptive benefit for the trees, or if it's just a kind of thing that emerges.
So there is still lots of mystery. Each masting species appears to be listening for a different set of signals. For some, it's wet winter weather. For others, it's dry. And plenty more, we just don't know.
For the most part, we really have very little idea why weather correlates with the acorn crop of any of these species.
And when your research subject is synonymous with age itself, the venerable oak or the ancient beech tree, it becomes increasingly important that your data look back further than just a single scientific career. To tackle that problem, Andrew and his colleague, David Ascoli, took on an immense project called Mass Tree.
Where we focused on European beech and Norway spruce. That was kind of our first step into compiling masting records. We were delving into the literature, contacting foresters and other forest researchers across Europe, diving into some pretty old archives right back from the 17th, 18th, 19th century, and pulling out records, harvest records, seed harvest records, all sorts of observations, and compiling them into one big database for those two species. And then a few years ago, we got some funding to ambitiously expand that project into Mastery Plus, which rather than focusing on two species, had the ambitious aim of trying to compile everything we could anywhere for any perennial plant species.
Enter Mastery Plus, an enormous open access database currently containing over 80,000 georeferenced observations from 974 species of perennial plants in 66 countries, organized into nearly 6,000 time series, dating back as far as the year 1677.
Enabling scientists like Andrew and Walt to turn back time and go beyond the question of the year-to-year weather to get at that of the climate.
I think the impact of climate change on masting has become one of the priority questions in the field. To see how it's changing over time, you need decades and decades of data. So in beech, mast years typically follow, in fact, very strongly follow years of high temperature, high summer temperatures. What's happened in the last few decades, as the climate has warmed very rapidly, is that these years of high summer temperatures are happening much, much more regularly. So an imperfect analogy is that the trigger of the gun is now being pulled so regularly that the gun hasn't always had time to be reloaded. The cues are happening so frequently, sometimes every year, every couple of years. The beech has not been able to replenish the resources, or some individuals have, others haven't, some have partially. But it seems like some species are more resilient to climate warming than others. This, again, is something that's very much at the frontier of what we know. And that's probably because different species have very slightly different, or in some cases, very different ways of regulating year-to-year variability in seed production. And so some species like beech might have a particular mechanism which just happens to be really sensitive to climate change. Other species might have mechanisms which are not so sensitive.
So, of course, climate change is starting to affect mast seeding. And in the case of European beech, it's a big problem, since its primary seed predator,
the voracious beech moth,
has gone from stochastic famine to prefix, you know, 3 square meals a day and the brood to match.
But as we know, different masting species have wildly varying trigger signals. So just as with climate change, you could imagine every plant and every place will be its own story.
A story about more than an individual, more than a population of trees, but of ripples moving outward through an ecosystem.
With all of their downstream effects, big and small.
Rippling into acorn woodpeckers.
And ground nesting birds.
Into mice and squirrels.
Deer.
And ticks.
And Lyme disease.
There are like whole species of bamboo that flower all together all over the world and then immediately die. the ultimate mast.
Yeah, a kind of mast suicide.
Oh no.
And then you've got broods of cicadas that sap trees of their energy.
Literally.
To the point where they might not even have enough to spare to mast when they otherwise would. Masting has all of these cascading ecological implications, many of them unknown or underexplored. And so we thought it was appropriate to drop a whole bunch of examples at once here at the end of the episode.
Especially because if you're hungry for even more stories about masting, our friends at all of these wonderful podcasts have made their own episodes for you to enjoy. Thanks again to Golden State Naturalist, Jumpstart Nature, Learning from Nature, Nature's Archive, and Outside In.
Thank you for joining us on this wildly zany experiment.
We've got links in the show notes.
And to put the cap on this little acorn, I want to reflect for a moment on where we are right now, not to draw too direct a line from this biological epiphenomenon to our sort of muddled human lives. But in my early 20s, I took a permaculture course delivered by a remarkable woman named Starhawk. And she had just written a book at that time called The Earth Path. And in that book, she was exploring natural patterns, right? Patterns and processes that we find in nature to learn what they can offer us for our social movements. Mm-hmm. Not just teach us about how to engineer widgets, right? Or how to design our architecture, but about how we organize ourselves, especially for change. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about masting in this respect because I, like a lot of people right now, am feeling a little depleted.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I have this feeling that there really is a need for, you know, a kind of massed movement, for lack of a better word.
Sure.
And there's something about these plants, right? Their ability to coordinate action on a massive continental, intercontinental sometimes scale without direct communication, right? Without passing information back and forth. But just because they are all responding together to signals that they all recognize, I think there's something to glean there.
I mean, like, critical mass is kind of the perfect example, right?
Right, right.
Like, on our own, we're just singular grains of pollen with impossible odds of actually making a change. We're scattered aimlessly on the wind. Mm-hmm. And on any normal day, bikes don't really stand a chance against the car hegemony. But then when enough people tuned in to the right signals, you know, they come together and they're undeniable.
And they can change the whole landscape.
So yeah, I guess as another author, Robin Wall Kimmerer, reminds us, in the context of masting, all flourishing is mutual. Thanks for listening, and thanks for letting us be our silly, nerdy selves. In this episode of Future Ecologies, you heard Walt Koenig and Andrew Hackett Payne. It was produced by me, Mendel Skolsky, and Adam Huggins, with help from Eden Zinchik. Music by Thumbug and Sunfish Moon Light. Cover art by Ale Silva. Once again, check out all the companion episodes from our friends. Links are in the show notes. If you want us to keep making this show, the best way to help is at patreon.com/futureecologies. You can support us for as little as $1 each month and get access to early releases, bonus episodes, our community Discord server, merch, and more. Let us know what you thought about this one. Leave us a comment or a review wherever you're listening. Till next time, there's power in numbers.